Good evening. My name is Arne Westad. I'm with the Cold War Studies Center. Let me welcome all of you to this lecture tonight, and especially, of course, our speaker, Professor Richard Cavadin from Oxford University. Professor Cavadin is the Rhodes Professor of American History at Oxford, and he's a fellow of St. Catherine's College. His work has mostly been on American politics, religion, and society in the early national and civil war era in the United States. He's an author of several books. Among them are Transatlantic Revivalism, Popular Evangelicalism in Britain and America from 1978, and Evangelicals and Politics in Antebellum America from 1993. Now, Evangelicals and Politics in Antebellum America, I'm told, refers to the 1840s and 1850s, not the 1990s, for those of you who might be wondering about that. The main reason why we have invited Professor Cavadin here tonight is his third book, his magnificent biography of President Lincoln, entitled Lincoln, A Life of Purpose and Power. In my view, Abraham Lincoln must be one of the most difficult subjects for a biography. The intensity of the man, which impressed or terrified his contemporaries, his incessant but shifting reasoning about the very purpose of America throughout his public career, and not least the discourse that Lincoln seemed engaged in both with his country and with himself during the terrible Civil War that he directed, about the relationship between morality and power. All of these make him, both as president and as a human being, a very difficult subject for any biographer to tackle. These themes that I've just mentioned, all of them come out in Professor Cavadin's biography, and he tackles them extremely well. And at least to this reader, his Lincoln biography is a true masterpiece of the biographer's craft. And luckily for us, I'm not the only one who has reached this conclusion, and luckily for the author as well, I should say. His Lincoln biography was published to great acclaim, not least in the United States, where he was the winner of the Gilda Lehmann Institute's Lincoln Prize for 2004, certainly the most prestigious prize in its field in the United States or anywhere in the world. It's an honor, by the way, I should mention that Professor Cavadin shares with, among others, the filmmaker Ken Burns, and with the historians Kenneth Stamp, David Herbert Donald, another author of a magnificent Lincoln biography, James McPherson, the great Civil War historian, John Hope Franklin, and David Blight, who we heard speak in the last meeting in this series. It's a great pleasure for me, Professor Cavadin, to welcome you to the LSE and to the Gilda Lehmann Lecture Series, and we're very much looking forward to hearing you tonight.
Well, thank you very much for those words of introduction. I have a theme in my lecture tonight, but I'm very happy in the question and answer session that will follow to take almost any question on Abraham Lincoln and his significance. A short stroll from here, on a granite pedestal in Parliament Square, there stands a bronze statue of Abraham Lincoln. You may know that this is a copy of an original, the work of Augustus and Gaudens, located in Lincoln Park, Chicago, depicting the 16th president in contemplative mode. It impressively lives up to its title of Lincoln the Man. The replica statue, a gift of the American people, was unveiled in July 1920 under the auspices of the Anglo-American Society. Lord Bryce presided over a public meeting at Central Hall, Westminster, at which the American ambassador, the ex-Secretary of State, Elihu Root, made a speech of presentation. The Prime Minister, David Lloyd George, responded, accepting the statue on behalf of the British people. A procession of worthies then made its way to the Canning enclosure on the west side of Parliament Square, where the Duke of Connaught, the president of the Anglo-American Society, unveiled the monument. The choir of Westminster Abbey sang the battle hymn of the Republic, American Civil War veterans laid a wreath, and the proceedings concluded with the British National Anthem. The episode was just one manifestation during the years of the Great War and its aftermath of what George Bernard Shaw described as a cult of Lincoln amongst the British, particularly amongst liberals. This was the period when a replica of George Barnard's Cincinnati statue of a rugged, angular, rough-hewn Lincoln was placed in Manchester. This is known as the stomach ache statue, since Lincoln's hands unintentionally suggest a man troubled with colic. And it commemorates the president's tribute to suffering Lancashire mill operatives during the wartime cotton famine. A little later, David Lloyd George, then an ex-prime minister, made a triumphal tour of North America. Fated as a wartime statesman of almost superhuman character, as the New York Times put it, he spent what he called a glorious day visiting the Kentucky birthplace of his lifelong hero. A little later, like other European pilgrims, he journeyed to pay his respects at Lincoln's tomb at Oak Ridge Cemetery in Springfield. Even before the Great War ended, the poet John Drinkwater had published a celebratory play, Abraham Lincoln, the first effective stage dramatization of Lincoln's life. It opened in Birmingham in 1918, and at Arnold Bennett's instigation transferred with spectacular success to London, to the Lyric Hammersmith. As a piece of history, the play is decidedly shaky, and much of the characterization is stereotypical, ludicrously so in the case of Frederick Douglass, the preeminent black abolitionist who speaks in a form of pidgin English, "Mr. Lincoln, great friend of my people much to learn, ignorant, frightened, suspicious people, but born free bodies, free, I born free, Mr. Lincoln, no man understand who not born slave." However, complete with a verse-speaking chorus, the play provided a stirring portrait of a president weighed down but not defeated by the pressures of war. And although the part of Lincoln himself was incongruously played by an actor with an Irish brogue, it was reported that all Mayfair went to see it. Hammersmith became a nightly pilgrimage for the West End. The play ran for hundreds of performances across the Atlantic and was several times revived in London over the next decade. Now, Drinkwater's inspiration was one of the earliest and most durable of all the scholarly lives of Abraham Lincoln, that by Godfrey Rathbone Benson, Lord Charnwood. In that study, published during the course of the Great War, the Oxford-educated Charnwood brought a sympathetic eye to bear on Lincoln's moral purpose, while avoiding the hagiography that had marked so many earlier biographies of the great emancipator. And it remained a discerning study. Charnwood told his readers to seize on Lincoln as an example of what wise, determined, and noble leadership might achieve. The author's English bearings prompted the occasional local allusion. He cast the American state governors as independent potentates acting usually in as much detachment from the nation's president as the Vice Chancellor of Oxford from the Board of Education. But Charnwood's essential vision was not provincial, it was panoramic, even universal. The liberal peer attributed to Lincoln a main role in what he called the wider cause of human good. Here was a plain, coarse-tongued master of political cunning whose honesty, intellectual rigor, and moral determination fashioned a statesman guided in shifting circumstances by great democratic and emancipatory principles, a leader driven by a larger philosophy than that of simple abolitionism. His statesmanship stands out as a singular instance of what the Greeks were after when they dreamt of a philosopher king. In the post-war world of Versailles and national reconstruction, others seized on Charnwood's Lincoln to fashion a figure of universal and not local relevance. Lincoln, the tragic, humble, Christ-like figure of history, had shown an exemplary devotion to democracy and freedom. "He hit us," Arnold Bennett said, "in our historical Puritan's wind. He seemed to incarnate our purpose, our usefulness, our sacrifice, This nobility, was it not ours? This man of government, of the people, by the people, for the people, was this not the new order promised by our politicians? Nay, actually being made in Paris by the people's representatives. And so Lincoln became the stuff our dreams are made of. Even the Times, which during Lincoln's presidency had been scornful at best, now recanted. We now know, as neither his countrymen nor we could then discern, that to him was given vision, and the measure of our present reverence is the measure of an earlier incomprehension. Here in England we should find in him inspiration, in the impartial and comprehensive quality of his mind, in the deep sanity and distinction of his character, in the charity and ambition of Lincoln's inaugural address, a prospectus for post-Civil War reconstruction, lay a prescription for the regeneration of the Western world in the aftermath of a war to make the world safe for democracy. No one made more of Lincoln's universal significance in history than John Drinkwater, in a set of essays addressed to the English-speaking world and which spelt out the underlying idealism of his play. Lincoln, the World Emancipator, not history, but romantic prospectus, presented Lincoln as a supreme exponent of the great principle of individual liberty within national unity, as the embodiment and inspiration of a profound community of constitutional method and ideal, now offered the chance to shape the present affairs of the world. Drinkwater articulated the shared self-understanding of Britons and Americans as joint defenders of progressive democratic government. As Lloyd George put it, Lincoln is one of those giant figures of whom there are very few in history who lose their nationality in death. Now, there are indeed elements in Lincoln's moral philosophy and political achievement whose broad, near-universal relevance helps to explain the appetite with which those in other societies and later generations have seized on him as a model. And it may help if I next set out the key elements of that philosophy and achievement. In essence, Lincoln's social and moral project was to construct an enterprising, commercially prosperous nation in which, under the equal operation of republican laws, each and every citizen would enjoy the right to rise and get the education needed to seize the chances presented by a fluid and expanding society. The logic of Lincoln's economic thought dictated a social and moral order at odds with Southern slavery. "I am naturally anti-slavery," Lincoln later wrote. "If slavery is not wrong, nothing is wrong. I cannot remember when I did not so think and feel." His argument drew especially on the doctrines of natural rights and human equality set out in the nation's founding texts. All men, black and white, should be free to enjoy the fruits of their own work. Free labor offered the prospect of improvement in condition and kept the social order fluid. Lincoln had no fear of a permanent proletariat. He saw no insuperable barriers to the social progress of any free, enterprising, and conscientious working man. Slavery, however, the enemy of this kind of economic meritocracy, stifled individual enterprise in both planters and slaves, and sustained a fundamental inequality, depriving human beings of the just rewards of their labor. In 1854, Stephen Douglas's Kansas-Nebraska Act opened up the Western Territory to slavery's expansion. From a position of historical defensiveness, the South's peculiar institution now appeared likely to swamp the nation. The act set Lincoln on a course that would culminate in his election to the presidency in 1860 as the candidate of a Republican Party united on the principle of quarantining slavery. The sharp clarity with which Lincoln identified the larger ethical issues at stake in the Nebraska Act thrilled his hearers, including radicals who had not previously considered him a kindred spirit. As well as engaging in a union-threatening piece of political perfidy, Lincoln argued, Douglas had reversed the settled policy of the Republic at a stroke. Douglas's popular sovereignty, he insisted, assumed a moral neutrality towards slavery, leaving it to local communities to decide the issue for themselves, with reference only to their material self-interest. Douglas's claim that the Nebraska Act had established the sacred right of self-government ran aground on the rocks of African-American manhood. If the Negro is a man, why then my ancient faith teaches me that all men are created equal, and that there can be no moral right in connection with one man's making a slave of another. The Declaration of Independence, in which Lincoln rooted his arguments, was for him a near sanctified statement of universal principles, and one that squared with essential elements of his personal religious faith, belief in a God who had created all men equal and whose relations with mankind were based on the principles of justice. Lincoln was clear enough where the Bible's principles led. Give to him that is needy is the Christian rule of charity, but take from him that is needy is the rule of slavery. Lincoln was scornful of Southern divines like the Presbyterian Frederick A. Ross, who had constructed a pro-slavery theology that concluded, as Lincoln put it, that it is better for some people to be slaves, and in such cases it is the will of God that they be such. But how was God's will to be established? Suppose Ross had a slave named Sambo. To the question, is it the will of God that Sambo shall remain a slave or be set free? God gives no audible answer, and the Bible, his revelation, gives none, or at most none, but such as admits of a squabble as to its meaning. But the fact that the question was to be resolved by Dr. Ross, who sits in the shade with gloves on his hands and subsists on the bread that Sambo is earning in the burning sun, gave little confidence that he would be actuated by that perfect impartiality which has ever been considered most favorable to correct decisions. Lincoln's election to the presidency in 1860 did nothing to alter his hostility to slavery, but by provoking the secession of seven states of the Deep South did everything to change his political priorities. He had expected his chief presidential task to stand firm on the quarantining of slavery. In practice, events had determined that his challenge would be the enforced reunion of a fractured nation. Yet Lincoln's underlying vision did not change. There are a number of strands in the rope which bound Lincoln resolutely to the Union. There was his profound faith in the nation's material potential. Far more often, however, Lincoln celebrated the political purpose of the Union and the moral magnificence of the nation's free institutions. The United States enjoyed a unique and unprecedented liberty. Most governments have been based practically on the denial of equal rights of men. Ours began by affirming those rights. They said some men are too ignorant and vicious to share in government. Possibly so, said we. And by your system, you would always keep them ignorant and vicious. We proposed to give all a chance, and we expected the weak to grow stronger, the ignorant wiser, and all better and happier together. Lincoln then gave the American Union a special role in history. As a beacon of liberty, liberty to all, it was the world's best hope. Thus, when the South Carolinians turned their guns on Fort Sumter in April 1861, they raised an issue which embraced, in Lincoln's words, more than the fate of these United States. It presents to the whole family of man the question whether a constitutional republic or a democracy, a government of the people, by the same people, can or cannot maintain its territorial integrity against its own domestic foes. For Lincoln, the rebellion had to be put down to prove to the world that popular government could be maintained against internal attempts at overthrow, that those who can fairly carry an election can also suppress a rebellion. Here is the key to the vision that sustained Lincoln throughout his presidency. The Union vessel was important only for the cargo it carried, liberty, equality, and a meritocratic society. During the war, Lincoln came to see that in order to preserve the cargo, he had to embrace the emancipation of the slaves. Many, then and since, judge this and his other acts relating to slavery to have been sluggish, grudging, and partial, and the case runs as follows. Lincoln made no mention of slavery when he defined the administration's purpose early in the conflict. During the first year of the war, he overturned military proclamations that freed the slaves of rebel masters. He sacked his Secretary of War for publicly proposing the arming of black soldiers, and he continued to cherish schemes of compensated emancipation and the colonizing of free blacks overseas. When Horace Greeley published his Prayer of 20 Million in the pages of his New York Tribune, calling on the president to grasp the nettle of emancipation, Lincoln's reply seemed only to confirm his cautious pragmatism. "My paramount object in this struggle is to save the Union and is not either to save or to destroy slavery." The Emancipation Proclamation, when finally issued on New Year's Day, 1863, applied only to those areas still in rebel hands. It freed only those slaves over whom it could have no immediate influence. It accepted the arming of black Americans not out of principle, but only because the Union Army desperately needed men. The problem with this assessment is that it neglects the political constraints on Lincoln's freedom of action. His priority in the early stages of the war was to prevent the remaining tier of slave states in the Upper South from leaving the Union. Their loss would have sealed the fate of the Union, given their rich resources. Had Lincoln declared the removal of slavery a war aim, Missouri, Maryland, and most seriously of all, Kentucky, would have been lost. His dalliance with compensated emancipation and with colonization has to be seen in this context, and against a background of deep-seated Northern racism. That the Emancipation Proclamation did not apply to slaveholding areas under the Union control was a mark not of Lincoln's cynicism, but of his understanding of the constitutional basis of the proclamation, namely as a measure of military policy which he was free to take as a commander-in-chief. By definition, it should not apply to those areas no longer in revolt. Lincoln's stance over the 2 years after he'd issued the proclamation is significant for his determination to follow through its logic in the arming of black troops, in the invocation of a new birth of freedom in the majesty of the Gettysburg Address, and in energetic efforts to secure a constitutional amendment to end slavery. On the eve of his death, Lincoln was proposing that certain categories of freedmen be given the vote. The emancipator, the moral exemplar, the Democrat, the exponent of the principles encoded in the Declaration of Independence, these were the models which prompted international appreciation of Lincoln and elicited tributes to his breadth of vision and understanding. There is, however, another aspect to Lincoln, one with a much more potent domestic than international appeal. The reality is that Lincoln's presidential achievement was also constructed upon his harnessing of a potent American nationalism, a willingness to tap into the deep wellsprings of a specifically American patriotism. Let me illustrate this with a snapshot. On the morning of the 21st of February, 1861, Abraham Lincoln stood to address the New Jersey Senate in the State House at Trenton. By now, the president-elect was entering the 11th day of an exhausting and roundabout journey that had brought him by rail from his Springfield home by way of civic and legislative gatherings in sundry towns and cities across Indiana, Ohio, and New York. He would, the next day, on the anniversary of George Washington's birth, travel on to Philadelphia and Harrisburg, and indeed would notoriously complete his journey to the nation's capital by nighttime stealth to avoid what the Pinkerton detective agents deemed a real risk of assassination. Lincoln made this journey east conscious that he would take office in what had become, since his election 3 months earlier, a deeply fractured Union. The Republicans' victory in that presidential contest had prompted the separationist gallop of the Lower South, whose 7 states had passed ordinances of secession by the 1st of February. Indeed, just a week before Lincoln had made his farewell to friends and neighbors in Springfield, representatives of 6 of those states met at Montgomery, Alabama, to lay the basis of the Southern Confederacy. By the time Lincoln reached the state capital of New Jersey, he'd already spoken dozens of times, on some occasions with a prepared speech, more often with just a few inconsequential remarks made from the platform of his railroad car. Born from the Trenton Depot by open carriage and accompanied by mounted marshals through muddied streets lined with the cheering crowds, Lincoln arrived at a Senate chamber which, according to his secretary John Hay, was already thronged. Yet, by some system of compression imperfectly known to me, room was made for the 50 or more that the special train had brought, and the chamber resounded to cries of "down in front" and "hats off." Lincoln's eventual appearance prompted a tumult of applause, lasting several minutes. As the gathering settled into silence, Lincoln turned to his carefully prepared text. "I cannot but remember the place that New Jersey holds in our early history," he began. "Away back in my childhood, I got hold of a small book, Weems's Life of Washington. I remember all the accounts there given of the battlefields and struggles for the liberties of the country, and none fixed themselves upon my imagination so deeply as the struggle here at Trenton, the crossing of the river, the contest with the Hessians, the great hardships endured at that time. I recollect thinking then, boy even though I was, that there must have been something more than common that those men struggled for. I am exceedingly anxious that that thing which they struggled for, that something even more than national independence, this union, the Constitution, and the liberties of the people, shall be perpetuated in accordance with the original idea for which that struggle was made. And I shall be most happy indeed if I shall be an humble instrument in the hands of the Almighty and of this, his almost chosen people, for perpetuating the object of that great struggle." Just repeat that. I shall be most happy indeed if I shall be an humble instrument in the hands of the Almighty and of this, his almost chosen people, for perpetuating the object of that great struggle. This resort to a form of sacred language had not been Lincoln's conventional or natural mode of address in his pre-presidential speeches. The allusions to Americans as a chosen people, albeit with some real qualification and hesitancy, was not one that came easily to Lincoln's lips. It was of a piece with the themes and tone of his speeches as he traveled east. In his first remarks of substance in Indiana, he reflected, "While some of us may differ in a political opinion, the common bonds of Christianity, civilization, and patriotism ensured that we are all united in one feeling for the Union." And thereafter, he continued to harness the common religious sensibilities of his audience by pointedly stressing his dependence on, sequentially, divine providence, God, the providence of God, that God who has never forsaken this people, the divine power without whose aid we can do nothing, that supreme being who has never forsaken this favored land, the maker of the universe and almighty God. And these themes, in language that played on the sacred sources of national identity, converged with particular clarity in this address to the New Jersey Senate. They would shortly find expression in the new president's inaugural address, through which Lincoln appealed for patience to allow for the workings of intelligence, patriotism, Christianity, and a firm reliance on him who has never yet forsaken this favored land, and drew to a close by affirming the nation's bonds of affection. The mystic cords of memory, stretching from every battlefield and every patriot grave to every living hearth and heart and hearthstone all over this broad land, will yet swell the chorus of the Union when again touched, as surely they will be, by the better angels of our nature. Lincoln's rhetoric was in part a measure of his need to appeal above and beyond party and to find a language in which to do so. "You give me this reception," he said, "as I understand, without distinction of party. I learn that this body is composed of a majority of gentlemen who, in the exercise of their best judgment in the choice of a chief magistrate, did not think I was the man. I understand, nevertheless, they came forward here as citizens of the United States to meet the man who, for the time being, is the representative man of the nation, united by a purpose to perpetuate the Union and the liberties of the people." Lincoln's resort to religious language was surely also a reflection of human pressure, the pressure that he felt as he left his home, a home of 25 years, to face the Union's most serious crisis. Now, Lincoln's religious beliefs are not easily fathomed. Few religious traditions have failed to embrace him. Friends have pointed to his Virginia Quaker forebears, Baptists to his parents' faith, Methodists to a supposed conversion at one of their camp meetings, Catholics to a surreptitious joining of their church, and Presbyterians to a public attendance on theirs. Masons, Unitarians, and Universalists have each clasped him to their bosoms. Following the visits of two or three mediums to the wartime White House, the Spiritualists claimed him as one of theirs, though Lincoln himself was facetiously dismissive, remarking that the contradictory voices of the spirits at these seances reminded him of his cabinet meetings. Well, it's not my purpose to explore the evidence relating to Lincoln's faith or his lack of it in his early and middle years. Given his taciturnity, the lack of any private journal, there's far too much room for unedifying speculation. But my judgment is that the young Lincoln, while no atheist, was influenced by the work of Tom Paine and other deists. But that as a husband, as a father, established lawyer in the 1840s and 50s, he drew closer to the orbit of conventional Protestant Christianity. Evincing a faith which owed something to Universalism and Unitarianism, but which didn't shake off the Calvinistic fatalism under whose influence he had been raised as a boy. Whatever Lincoln's religious views on the eve of his presidency, his wartime experience encouraged an increasing profundity of faith. Not only did he feel a sense of personal responsibility for a war of unimagined savagery, but the conflict brought him trials closer to home, the death of friends, close colleagues, and above all, the loss through typhoid of a beloved son, Willie, in February 1862. He attended public worship more habitually than ever before. He found in his darkest nights increasing solace in the scriptures. On one occasion, Elizabeth Keckley, Mary Lincoln's seamstress, curious to see what particular Bible passages he was reading, crept behind him and found him deep in the book of Job. Before the war, Lincoln regarded superintending providence as a remote, mechanistic power, but under the pressure of events, he exchanged that providence for an active and more personal God, an intrusively judgmental figure, one more mysterious and less predictable than the ruling force it superseded. Lincoln made several public theological forays during his presidency. Between the summer of 1861 and the autumn of 1864, he issued 9 separate proclamations appointing days of fasting, national fasting, humiliation, and prayer, and days of thanksgiving, many of them prompted by moments of despair or elation occasioned on the battlefield. In addition, several of his public letters and his responses to visiting clergy provided the public with a strong sense of the president's understanding of the workings of the Almighty. Most notable of all, Lincoln's inquiry in his second inaugural address into the meaning of the war gave the speech the character of a sermon. And collectively, these writings present 3 major lines of thought. Every nation was a moral being with duties. God's purposes were wise and mysterious. And the American Union, under God, promised to be an agent of moral and political transfiguration. Lincoln's Calvinistic frame of thought prompted him to conceive of the Almighty as the ruler of nations as well as of men, to identify nations as moral entities equally as capable of transgressions against the divine law as the individuals who composed them. Thus, he explained, nations like individuals are subjected to punishments and chastisements in this world. Lincoln made clear his conviction that the nation's continuing trials related specifically to its perpetuating the wrong of slavery. God's punishment of the nation for slavery, Lincoln frequently reflected, was part of the Almighty's purposes, which were, he declared, mysterious and unknown to us. He offered no clearer and more memorable statement of his views than in 2 remarkable letters to Eliza P. Gurney of the Society of Friends. If I'd had my way, he said, this is 18 months into a conflict to which he could see no imminent conclusion, if I'd had my way, this war would have been ended before this, but we find it still continues and we must believe that God permits it for some wise purpose of his own. 2 years later, shortly after William Tecumseh Sherman had transformed the Union's military prospects by taking Atlanta, Lincoln told her, "The purposes of the Almighty are perfect and must prevail, though we are erring mortals and may fail, and we may fail accurately to perceive them in advance. We hope for a happy termination of this terrible war long before this, but God knows best and has ruled otherwise. Surely he intends some great good to follow this mighty convulsion, which no mortal could make and no mortal could stay." However mysterious God's purpose is then, and however disobedient the nation, there was reason to believe that a purified union would emerge from the fiery trial of war. Lincoln's Thanksgiving proclamations marveled at the gracious gifts of the Most High God, who had delivered fruitful fields, productive industry, an increasing population, and reasons to expect continuance of years with large increase of freedom. At the dedication of the Gettysburg Cemetery, he memorably reformulated this idea in a non-scriptural rhetoric of salvation and renewal. For loyal Unionists, the great task was to resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. Lincoln's theology, with its strain of humility and its remarkable lack of self-righteousness, stands in some contrast to the theology of the mainstream Union pulpits, mostly confident that God was on their side. Yet Lincoln and the loyal Protestant clergy largely spoke a common theological language, and this would be a matter of considerable political and not just theological significance. Lincoln's call in April 1861 to put down the rebellion generally drew Northern Protestants onto a common platform. Pre-war conservative conciliators and radical higher law evangelicals now united in a great people's war for Christian democracy. This was a unity qualified by a few principled pacifists, Quakers, Mennonites, and by a few guarded dissenters. But the vast majority of Northern Protestant clergy trumpeted their support for a war to prevent national annihilation. One editor doubted if in the history of the world so many pulpits had thundered against rebellion as on the last Sunday of the first month of the war. Those pulpits then and during the rest of the conflict helped to crystallize ideas about the nature and meaning of the American nation. Protestant leaders strove to make sense of unfolding events. Nations, they knew, had a primary and essential place in God's moral economy. He worked through them to achieve his purposes. He was a supreme arbiter of their affairs. Every nation's days were numbered, but no nation would die until its purposes were achieved. Few, though, conceded that the American Union faced imminent destruction. Indeed, none doubted that God had chosen the nation for special favor and a particular role. In the finest territory on the face of the globe, America had reached a state of advanced civilization, separated from the discordant elements of the old world. Americans enjoyed the richest inheritance of civil and religious freedom ever bequeathed to any nation in ancient or modern times. They were guided by the best government that was ever constituted since the world began. America had a mission that would see her conquer the world. But this was no conventional lust for conquest. As a latter-day Israel, America's role was to serve by example the welfare of the whole human race. This made the rebellion of the South not only political treason against the secular nation, but profanity or treason against God. Protestants used the Pauline doctrine of obedience to civil rulers, let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, to show that there could ordinarily be no such thing as a Christian rebel. Secondly, they celebrated the grand providential purposes for which God had raised up their Christian republic. They were fighting, one said, for free government in all lands for all ages to come. Ancient republics stand on the page of history as discouraging failures, and the modern republics in the old world have gone down in blood. Our government was organized with the conservative element of Christian faith to give stability to the work. If it is cast down, when may mankind be expected to repeat the experiment? If the Confederacy represented the vilest treason ever known since the great secession from heaven, so dispatching Jefferson Davis to the same quarters as Lucifer, then the question arose, why was God putting the whole nation through this time of trial? For many, the war was part of a testing process of discipline, characteristic of America's history. As Israel had been chastised to purge corruption, so the rigors of the early colonial settlements and the revolution itself had helped to purify the American nation. And what above all explained the nation's paroxysm was its complicity in the peculiar institution. As a visiting group of clergy told Lincoln in September 1862, the Almighty had bared his arm in behalf of the American slave and now commanded the nation's rulers, as he once had ordered Pharaoh, "Let my people go." Yet whatever punishment God might mete out, there were no grounds for despair. Out of the severity of war would come a transfigured nation. Homer Dunning, a Connecticut Congregationalist, fused Christ and the Union. "I rejoice to be with the nation when on its Calvary it is crucified by its own children. Our children and children's children will speak of 1861 as we speak of 1776. And when the nation shall have covered the continent, when it shall have overmastered the monster of slavery, and when it shall stand up transfigured with divine beauty for the doing of God's will, men will give thanks to God for this great and sore trial." Dunning's words remind us that many anti-slavery Protestants who would not have considered themselves abolitionists before the war soon saw that the logic of events would turn the conflict into an assault on slavery. And by the summer of 1864, even old-school conservatives had come to the view that for the preservation of our national life, slavery should be at once and forever abolished. The logic of evangelicals' understanding of events culminated in the certainty that, as one Episcopalian put it quite simply, God is with us, and the Lord of hosts is on our side. Without question, God was against the rebels. How could he possibly smile upon rebellion, treason, and a nationality with slavery as its cornerstone? A few preachers warned against hubris and self-righteousness. As Charles Fowler put it, the only way to get God on our side is to get on his side. But usually this appetite for self-criticism coexisted with a belief in the North's moral superiority. A myriad northern pulpits deemed the Union to be engaged in a sacred cause hallowed with the blood of its best and noblest sons. The North's sins were stains that could be washed away, but the Confederacy's were systemic evils removable only by destroying the body itself. It is not merely war between sections, between North and South, between Abraham Lincoln and Jefferson Davis, explained one Methodist minister. It is war between God on one side and a gigantic wrong on the other. If Unionist Protestants were commonly more confident than Lincoln that God was on their side, in other respects, as this summary suggests, the themes of the president's public theology harmonized well with their own. Lincoln's originality lay rather more in his memorable expression of an idea than in the idea itself. Both he and they knew that nations had a place in the Almighty's moral economy, both conceived of an interventionist God, both understood that the Union under divine providence to amount to more than a glorious experiment in liberty and republicanism. Both understood slavery to compromise that design. And this broad congruence between Lincoln's public theology and that of religious loyalists had rich meaning for the wartime politics of the Union. Mainstream Protestants embraced Lincoln as one of them. And Lincoln worked energetically to mobilize the churches behind the war effort. Amongst the complex of ingredients that made for the Union's eventual victory, none was more important than its capacity to sustain popular patriotism, despite the enormous cost in human suffering. Without a regenerating patriotism during this protracted trial, the Lincoln administration would have foundered on the rocks of war weariness. The White House understood the importance of harnessing a range of voluntary organizations to this end. These included the political parties and the federal army, but none was more potent as a moral influence than the nation's churches. Of these, none could match the power of evangelical Protestantism, the millions of Methodists, Baptists, Presbyterians, Congregationalists, and others who made up the country's most formidable religious grouping. Lincoln thus strove to maintain good relations with church leaders. He met a full gamut of religious visitors who came to lecture him, to offer opinions, to seek appointments, or pay their respects. They included nationally renowned preachers, well-placed editors of mass circulation papers, and distinguished abolitionists. There were representatives of the agencies devoted to the well-being of soldiers. Lincoln held meetings with Sabbatarians, with temperance men, and with Covenanters seeking a Christian amendment to the federal constitution. Critics missed the political value of these meetings. I wish that General Halleck would put a guard on the White House to keep out the committees of preachers and grannies that absorb Lincoln's time and thought, grumbled General Sherman. But Lincoln himself recognized that these meetings served a much larger political purpose. For their part, thousands of Union clergy saw in Lincoln a president who warranted respect, even admiration, not simply ex officio, but because they found in him qualities to be extolled. There was no personal cult of Lincoln, yet popular perceptions of Lincoln mattered in sustaining the Union administration as a whole. And these perceptions were shaped to an extent by preachers who used their position to review the president's qualities and to place him within the divine economy. Scrutinizing Lincoln's character and demeanor, loyal clergy mostly provided a counterweight to popular impatience over the Union's snail-like progress on the battlefield and over what was deemed the paralysis of the administration itself. In sermons, tracts, and newspapers, Protestant ministers told of the president's admirable honesty, determination, integrity, and unflinching patriotism. In a quintessential example of loyal preaching, the Methodist George Peck delivered a two-hour sermon on a text from the book of Nehemiah, in which he ingeniously turned Nehemiah into the president of the country, beset by secessionist rebels who sought to prevent its rebuilding. Peck transparently wants his audience to view Lincoln in the precise terms in which he describes President Nehemiah, a man of great executive ability, of great courage, of great prudence, and a profound knowledge of human nature. A man of much prayer, a man of great faith in God, whose Puritan rule elicited the contempt of secessionists who don't pray much, but curse and swear and never work. A most obstinate man in the face of political mischief, a man of a thousand who could not violate his conscience and whom neither force nor fraud, threats nor flattery could jostle a hair's breadth. This approving association of Lincoln with what his critics disparaged as Puritanism, that is, the conscience-driven evangelicalism of New England and its diaspora, derived in part from the president's setting aside more days for national religious observance, including the first ever national Thanksgiving, than any of his predecessors, many of whom had jibbed at a practice which seemed to trespass on the separation of church and state. Although Lincoln continued to disappoint those hoping that he would confess Christ as his personal savior, many observers perceived in Lincoln a capacity for reverence and deep religious feeling. Jonathan Turner remarked that both president and people seemed to imagine that he is a sort of halfway clergyman. Many saw him as an instrument of the divine will, operating under providence to become, after George Washington, the second savior of our country. As freedom became a reality, African Americans regarded the President Emancipator as an Old Testament prophet, a Joshua fighting the battle of freedom. Most vividly of all, a Chicago Methodist believed he'd located the true theory and solution of this terrible war in the remark of one of the city's lawyers, "You may depend upon it, the Lord runs Lincoln." Together, Lincoln's cultivation of loyalist religious constituencies and their reciprocal confidence in him contributed signally to the larger mobilization of nationalist sentiment. There was much more to religious unionist activity than an exposition within consecrated space of a Christian case for patriotism. Cadres of Protestants acted as ideological shock troops well beyond their conventional domain, recruiting volunteer soldiers for the Union and Christ, energizing the aid societies that served the Union's fighting men, ministering as field chaplains to inspire the troops with the nation's millennial purposes, and participating as organizers in the home front politics of national defense. Union evangelicals engaged in urgent drum beating on behalf of the Union administration. With remarkable consistency, Protestant spokesmen lined up to defend the administration's conscription measures, its tolerance of arbitrary arrests, and its strong arm action against draft resistors and dissenters. There were, of course, anti-administration clergy and lay sympathizers who remained a self-conscious minority within mainstream Northern Protestantism. But the reality was that most of the North's politically active Protestants were either deeply committed to Lincoln's administration or, as radical critics, had nowhere else, electorally speaking, to go. The 1864 presidential campaign witnessed the most complete fusing of religious crusade and political mobilization in America's electoral experience. Ministers engaged in a fervent round of ward meetings, election speeches, sermons, addresses to troops, and editorializing. Religious Tract Society agents distributed campaign literature. Churches became Union Republican clubs. The president's re-election was due in large part to the extraordinary mobilization of support by those who saw themselves as agents of God and of Lincoln, the leaders of the Protestant churches. Amongst the thousands of correspondents who sought to sustain Lincoln during the Civil War was one Ephraim Shaler, a crippled veteran of the War of 1812. "Don't, for God's sake, give or yield one inch, or parley a moment with the rebel traitors and murderers, till they lay down the weapons of rebellion and sue for peace," he urged the president during the first month of the war. "Every traitor should be hung in accordance with the laws of God and man. If I had a foot big enough, with body and strength in proportion, I would kick the whole state of South Carolina into the Gulf of Mexico. Have no fears of the final result. The multitudes of loyal Americans will sustain you, and God will overthrow all your enemies. God speed the right." 2.5 years later, the trials of war had shaken none of Shaler's confidence. "Mr. President, you need have no fears in regard of the termination of this unholy war. God is a prayer-hearing God, and he will most assuredly hear and answer the 10,000 prayers offered up morning and evening by," and here Shaler made no concession to doubt, "the prayers offered up morning and evening by his own chosen people through the length and breadth of our land, that he would go forth with our armies and give them victory in every future conflict till the rebels lay down their arms and return to their allegiance. All the blood and suffering in this cruel war rests upon their guilty souls." And then he crosses out, "if they have any souls. May God in his infinite mercy keep and protect you from all harm, guide you safely through the storm, and give you and the whole nation to see his mighty power in giving peace to our beloved country." It was men like Shaler whose single-minded determination provided the bedrock of Unionism. It was their nationalism on which Lincoln would rely politically, and on which he encouraged by his allusion to the Union's special role in providential dispensation as the last best hope of the world, as hope to the world for all future time, and as something that held out a great promise to all the people of the world for all time to come. Yet we have to return to the Lincoln who could speak more cautiously of the almost chosen people, of a nation which should be wary of self-righteousness and remain alert to its moral failings. He expressed this idea no more powerfully than in his second inaugural address, from which I have refrained from quoting so far, but it's there that the almost of this almost chosenness is to be found most powerfully expressed. I quote, "Woe unto the world because of offenses, for it must needs be that offenses come, but woe to that man by whom the offense cometh." And here, of course, Lincoln is quoting scripture. If we shall suppose that American slavery is one of those offenses, which, in the providence of God, he now wills to remove, and that he gives to both North and South this terrible war as the woe due to those by whom the offense came, shall we discern therein any departure from those divine attributes which the believers in a living God always ascribe to him? Fondly do we hope, fervently do we pray, that this mighty scourge of war may speedily pass away. Yet if God wills that it continue, until all the wealth piled by the bondman's 250 years of unrequited toil shall be sunk, and until every drop of blood drawn with the lash shall be paid by another drawn with the sword, so still it must be said, the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. It was, and it is, this Lincoln, St. Gaudens's Lincoln the Man of Parliament Square, who has exerted such a hold on political and public imagination well beyond the limits of the United States. Above all, for his depth of moral understanding, a moral understanding which is both uncommon in political leaders and timeless in its relevance. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Covenant, for a lecture that was encompassing, very poignant at the same time. We are greatly in your debt. I wanted to start by asking a question that I'd like to ask of any biographer. What was it that drew you to Lincoln in the first place in terms of writing a biography, which is a huge undertaking, and particularly for a subject who'd been dealt with in a number of highly regarded biographies before?
I'm afraid the answer is really pretty prosaic. I was asked to write a book on Lincoln many years ago, rather more years ago than I care to remember, and embarrassingly large number of years ago, back in the late 1980s. I'd been teaching for a decade and a half, or maybe a bit longer, and certainly been studying Lincoln as a student and as a teacher of American history, of 19th century political history, for 20 years. Always had a fascination, the inevitable fascination for Lincoln. And one could say in the late 1980s, when approached by a British publisher, that what was indeed needed was a short political study of Abraham Lincoln. Because during the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, there's a dearth of academic writing, scholarly writing on Lincoln. I think there's an interesting question as to why that should be, and I could elaborate if need be. But let's just suffice to say that by the late 1980s, there is no good short political study. There was a little volume of essays by Richard Current, which some of you may know, The Lincoln Nobody Knows, a set of really quite sharply focused essays, but nothing which took Lincoln as a political figure and analyzed the sources of his political support. The series in question, the Longman Profiles in Power series, seemed to be the ideal vehicle for that kind of study, since it was not designed as a series of biography so much as a series of analyses. But I took so long over getting down to this study that by the time I began work in the mid-90s, the series had been taken over, the publisher had been taken over by Pearson. And the editor then said, well, what they really wanted was a biography. So I decided I would fuse these two elements in one. I would write a narrative, a study which was sufficiently narrative to tell a biographical story, but which would nonetheless impose on that story an analytical organization. I suppose that's the honest answer. If I were rationalizing, as one of course does as an academic, if I were rationalizing...
Why didn't you turn them down?
I would say, well, of course, I'd been working for all these years on evangelical Protestants in American politics. I had a sense of the importance of evangelicalism in the antebellum years, and that I felt that the study of Lincoln had failed to place him in that particular political milieu. Now, that is true, and that is the line that I would have taken in this more analytical study that I was first lined up to write. But I think that is something of a rationalization. And if I were to go back and to pull out the prospectus, the publisher's prospectus, or my proposal, I should say, to the publisher, it would bear no relationship at all to the book that's finally emerged. But you're right. I would not have taken on this project in 1987, had I thought that what I was doing was writing a biography of Lincoln, which would be challenging all those tens of thousands of other works on the Civil War and Lincoln himself.
Most great books are being created, not in one piece, but in several. Other questions? Yes, Alistair.
Thank you very much for the lecture. It's working. I agree with you that Lincoln would do anything to save the Union, and Lincoln saw the United States as a unique example of republicanism, a unique form of government. One might argue that, you know, Jefferson or Jackson or Washington would have said the same thing and done the same thing, and of course they were all slaveholders. During the war, he's prepared to emancipate the slaves and mobilize the churches in order to let the North win. And all of that one would agree with as well. What I'm more interested in, because you were kind enough to say you might answer slightly wider questions, is the attitude of Lincoln towards, you know, blacks rather than slaves. I mean, in his famous debate with Stephen Douglas in 1858, he's quite blunt and he says there's a superior race and an inferior race. The whites are superior, the blacks are inferior. And more or less says this will always be the case. When it comes to the Reconstruction of America after the war, he's very indulgent, to say the least, in his 10% plan about the South coming back. And one feels, at least I feel, that if he were around, if he had lived, if he hadn't been shot, he would probably have had as much of a struggle with radical Republicans as perhaps Andrew Johnson did. There were lots of white abolitionists and white Republicans who were against slavery but didn't particularly like blacks and didn't want them in the North and didn't want competition for against free labor. Given Lincoln's rather blunt statements in that debate with Douglas in 58 and his rather indulgent stance towards Reconstruction, when one looks at Lincoln as a moral beacon, do you think all that detracts from it? Or he's an emancipator, but did he actually believe that blacks and whites were equal?
Thank you.
Well, a nice question, and I think I would take issue with two of your premises. One is that the statement in 1858 is a blunt statement of white racial superiority. I think it is that. I think it's really quite a defensive statement in a setting where politically he was confronting a race baiter and a demagogue who was using the race prejudice of which was probably more acute in the Northwest, Western states than in any of the free states. Certainly that's what de Tocqueville thought. And Lincoln, if you look, you're right to say that Lincoln shared many, I think, of the racial assumptions of his day. He tolerated, did not question the black laws of the Northwest, which did indeed give blacks a secondary civil and social position. But nowhere does he categorically say that the black race is inferior to the white. He says he would give them an inferior position, but I think there is an ambiguity about Lincoln's language in 1858. In a setting where he could have been much more outspoken and found it politically advantageous to have been so. So I think Lincoln shows a humanity towards the black race before the Civil War. But I would agree with you that he's not an abolitionist. He believes slavery to be a wrong, and he takes a stand in the late 1850s. He's one of a minority of two in the Illinois House of Legislature to enter a protest against the resolution of the larger house that slavery and the rights of slaveholders are to be defended and are right. He wants to qualify that. But I do take your point that the Lincoln before the Civil War talks about colonization, the voluntary deportation of the black race, and I think he shares many of the assumptions. I would simply, in response to your first point, that I think there's rather more qualification than you give him credit for. I don't think there's any doubt at all that during the war, Lincoln comes to understand and appreciate the humanity, the full and equal humanity of the black race once he sees black soldiers in action. And I think this was not questioned by Frederick Douglass. Frederick Douglass, who saw Lincoln early in the war as yet another white politician who had no feeling for the realities of slavery and the black race, comes subsequently to appreciate the humanity that Lincoln displays towards his fellow men, the respect that he accords to them. And I think if you look very closely at Lincoln's Reconstruction policy and the steer that he is giving leaders in Louisiana during 1863 and 1864, he is using his energies to push the leaders locally, where, of course, slavery is still in operation. He is pushing them to adopt a free constitution. He's pushing them towards emancipation at a point when they don't politically have to, when they don't legally have to. And he's pushing for a franchise, an enfranchisement for free blacks, certain categories of free blacks in Louisiana. The speech that caused him his life, that lost him his life, which is the one he delivers on the 11th of April in 1865, just a few days before he goes to the theater, is the speech at the White House when a crowd gathers to hear what they want, namely, what they expect, I should say, namely a speech of triumph in victory. And what they get from Lincoln is this rather tedious exposition of what he wants to see happen in Louisiana. He's already turning his mind to the issue of Reconstruction. Indeed, it's been playing on his mind for a couple of years. And in that speech, he speaks openly about the need to move to the franchise for certain categories of blacks, for educated blacks. So Lincoln is moving through the war. There's an evolution of Lincoln's position. He's always been an emancipationist from the earliest days. That doesn't mean to say that when he arrives in the White House in April of 1861, he plans on emancipation. But emancipation was not something that he was dragged to. I mean, Lerone Bennett says he was forced into glory. And of course, there were very considerable pressures from runaway slaves themselves. The Union armies were having to contend with tens of thousands of runaways. So of course, there's a real problem. But Lincoln, I think, grasps that with some warmth. And positively after the summer of 1862. So my final point would be, I think, actually Lincoln, if we want to speculate and be counterfactual, I think Lincoln would have made a better fist of Reconstruction. I suspect the long-term consequence would have been a little different. I suspect we would have had Jim Crow by the 1890s. But Lincoln would have had the political capital, the political leverage over a party which he was used to. He'd spent the whole of his life, he'd spent 30 years helping to construct this party through the Whig Party into the Republican Party. So he was a wonderful political manager. He had, I think, would have had all the respect that would come to the president who had led the Union into reunion with the Confederacy. And we need, I think, to remember finally that his policy towards Reconstruction was based on the understanding that an extreme act leads to an extreme counter-reaction, and that his whole political career had been based on an understanding that you move by gradualism and not by radicalism. So he would, I think, have taken a different tack from the radical Reconstructions, radical Republicans, but he would have been able to hold the moderate Republicans on board.
Yes, a question at the very back over there. Gentleman at the back. Could you just show me your hands, those who want to ask questions? Yes, please.
Thank you. I'm really fascinated by this whole idea of the perception of the nation as a chosen people. And I wondered to what extent that was original to Lincoln, or was he tapping into an already rich vein of that? Because it does seem to be historically something that is true of the American people, but also previously of the British people. So it's interesting that both Anglo-Saxons seem to possess that view of themselves, and I wondered if you could comment on that.
There's a deep cultural reservoir there on both sides of the Atlantic. The language of chosen nation is there in the English Civil War in the 17th century. It's certainly there in Puritan understanding of self-conscious understanding from the earliest days of the city on a hill. A sense of a baton being passed from the days of Christ through maybe even earlier, but certainly from the days of Christ. This is of course a Protestant conception, but it's there. I mean, Anthony Smith of this institution would say that the idea of chosenness and of sort of sacral understanding of nationhood is really very wide ranging. It's by no means restricted to the British and the Americans. But you're right to ask the question. It is deep in the culture. Lincoln is speaking to that. It's a phrase he uses only the once. He talks about this favored nation, but only once does he talk about chosen nation. And of course, he qualifies it in the way in which I've suggested. Very Lincolnian. But it seems to me that what he's doing, Lincoln is the author of all of his speeches. He doesn't have a script writer, a ghost writer. He thinks very carefully about what he says. One of the reasons why he was very reluctant to speak on the journey from Springfield to Washington was he didn't want to be led into saying something that he would regret. And when ensconced in the White House throughout the war, he was very reluctant to say more than a few remarks to people who came to serenade him. So the choice of word in this setting, Trenton, and in a carefully prepared speech was calculated for political effect. Lincoln is too honest, intellectually honest a person to use the term unadulterated chosen nation. So he uses the term almost chosen nation. And what I think he does, the brilliant genius as a politician, I use that word advisedly, I think he is a political genius. What he's achieving, of course, through the war is the bringing on board these mainstream Protestants without himself subscribing to those views personally. I don't mean to say he's hypocritical because he never declares himself to be an evangelical, but his own religious views are unorthodox, views which subscribe a position in which he subscribes to the idea of a maker.
Please.
You spoke about Abraham Lincoln's moral opposition to slavery, his feeling that slavery was immoral. I'm wondering whether you think that he viewed slavery as also being illegal under the Constitution. As a lawyer, it seems that he would have cared a great deal about the legal aspect of whether or not the Constitution itself permitted slavery. And it seems from the way that he issued the Emancipation Proclamation, you might think he actually does kind of think that the Constitution allowed for the institution for the existence of slavery. Given this, I'm wondering whether or not did Abraham Lincoln, did he see himself as in some ways reconstituting, writing an original sin that had been in American life to begin with, or did he see himself going back to the Constitution, to the true meaning of it? Did he see himself bringing in a new era of how America conceives itself, or did he see it as being already there? Because he was very concerned with the legal, with the legal aspect of the question.
That's a great question.
Very, very good question. Yes. Well, Lincoln is a conservative lawyer, and conservative in his understanding of the Constitution as a compromise between slave states and free states, and recognizes that, or takes the view, which of course is the overwhelming majority view in his time, that the rights of Southern slave owners under the Constitution are indeed constitutional and legal, that they are proper, they are to be defended. And Lincoln, for that reason, much to the anger of the more radicals in the Free Soil and then the Republican Party, and a number of abolitionists, much to their anger, or at least to Lincoln's discredit in their eyes, Lincoln supports the fugitive slave law, the rights of slave owners to the return of their slaves, and under the clause of the Constitution which says that slave owners shall be, and of course it's phrased in a rather euphemistic way, but it's clear that that's what's intended by that clause of the Constitution, that slaves shall be returned to their owners. So Lincoln had no doubt that Southern slavery would be wound up only by the will, the majority will, of the people of those states. And indeed, there's an irony in the fact that the 13th Amendment that Lincoln was prepared to support on the eve of taking office, and indeed he alludes to this in his first inaugural address, is an amendment which would have embedded slavery in the Constitution beyond the reach of the federal government. It would have declared what was generally, it would have made clear what was already understood, but it would have declared that slavery would only come to an end when the people of those states chose themselves to remove it. So Lincoln was prepared to put that guarantee in because he believed that the Union was a union within which ultimately that emancipation would come about. He saw slavery as an archaic institution, as out of keeping with, out of tune with the times, that if you quarantine it, if you stop it expanding, it would eventually die a death, because it was certainly wrong, but it was also inferior to a system based on free labor. What changes the world for Lincoln is the Kansas-Nebraska Act of 1854, which opens up the northern part of the Louisiana Purchase to the settlement by slave owners. Up to that point, it's understood under the Missouri Compromise of 1820 that that area will be closed to slaveholders. And the opening up of that territory and the prospect of plantation slavery, slaves being taken in, is what moves Lincoln, along with hundreds of thousands of others of Northerners, and moves them into this new creation, the Republican Party, staggered over a number of months and years, so that by 1856 the Republican Party is the second party to the Democratic Party, the party of Pierce and Buchanan. So it's a very nice question. Lincoln, even as a lawyer in the 1840s, is prepared to defend in court the rights of a slave owner, the return of a slave. And he's known, therefore, by Wendell Phillips, Massachusetts abolitionist, as that slave hound from Illinois. But there's a radicalism within Lincoln's position as well, and a moral spine which is consistently on view from 1854. The action of Douglas in opening up the Louisiana Purchase in that way has really made it absolutely clear what the question is that the nation is facing as far as Lincoln's concerned. And he articulates this brilliantly in speech after speech from 1854 onwards. There's really only one theme in his speeches from 1854 until his election in November of 1860.
I'm afraid we have to make that the final question for this evening, and the final question in the last in the series this year of Gilda Lehrman lectures. We've had three fantastic lectures. The last one that we heard today, not least. I would like to thank the Gilda Lehrman Institute of New York for funding and organizing this series of lectures. They've promised us that we will be able to continue this series with three other great historians of the United States next year. We're much looking forward to that. Tonight, let me thank you, Richard, very much for your wonderful lecture, and we hope to see you back here at LSE soon.
Thank you.